is the Grillion Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's Beyond the Fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grillion Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
You're dang right it is. From hundreds of miles beneath terra firma in the depths of the Hollow Earth, live from the Grillion Bunker. Yes, my friends, welcome again to the dark disquiet emanating from that deepest portion of the web known as the Mohorovic discontinuity. It is the Grillion Report, and I'm your host, Micah Hanks, settling in for another week in the weird and glad to be your host as we delve into all strange things that are taking place in the world around us right now. In fact, during hour two tonight, Dr. John Hart of Boston University will be joining us and discussing his new book, Cosmic Commons. Here during hour one, we'll be catching up on what's been going on in the news, including some of this weather that's been going on. You know, actually, I have to be honest. I'm normally broadcasting from the bunker, but I'm up here on the ninth floor of Grillion International Megaplex so that I can see what's happening. There's snow all over the place in downtown Asheville, and all hell breaking loose down on the street as I'm watching emergency service crews driving back and forth and back and forth. Now, initially, the red and the yellow lights flashing, I thought maybe a UFO had landed. Not so much. I wasn't so lucky. But that's quite all right. So we'll be keeping abreast of what's going on with what I think, appropriately dubbed the Polar Plunger. You know, the last one was the Polar Vortex, and this one, I think, should be the Polar Plunger. No, really. I mean, the news sources are actually calling it the Polar Plunge. I hope our guest will still be able to join us. I mean, up there in Boston, it's got to be bad. I know McNonymous, my buddy up in New York, he's been having a hard time. And it's looked like white Christmas down here in Asheville, North Carolina, where I live today. So I had been holed up in the bunker, but I thought, you know, I'd better go above ground for tonight's broadcast. And broadcast from Studio D, way up here on the ninth floor. So that said, it's been a rather devilish week, hasn't it? I'm sure you know what I'm talking about, especially if you weren't tuning in to the Micah Hanks program Sunday night, and instead you were watching the Grammys. Now, I'm not going to get too much into the Grammys right now myself. But if you'd like to hear a little commentary on that subject, you can check out this week's edition of Middle Theory. But you know, it's funny because I hear that one of the singers in the audience had allegedly walked out because they felt that some of the Grammys performances, specifically, I think one of the more controversial ones I've been hearing about was, it wasn't Miley Cyrus this time, it was Beyonce. But they're literally alleging that the Grammys this year were satanic. We've come right back into the heart of satanic panic, and it's broken out at the Grammys. I mean, there was a lot of controversy about, of course, the political statement made on same-sex marriage and all that. But maybe elsewhere in the world there really is something dark afoot. Or as my friends Bill and Ted would say, something strange is afoot at the Circle K. Let's actually not say the Circle K, let's say maybe the Vatican instead. A religious requillary containing blood from the late Pope John Paul II has apparently been stolen from a remote mountain church in Italy, with speculation that a satanic group could be behind the theft. That or maybe vampires, right? Now, a team of around 50 police officers with sniffer dogs were on Monday searching for any trace of the reliquary, which was stolen from the Church of St. Peter in Ionica in the Abruzzo Mountains over the weekend. The ornate gold object contains a fragment of material stained with blood, which was purportedly taken from the clothing worn by John Paul II after he was shot during the failed attempt on his life at St. Peter's Square in 1981. The relic had been donated to that church in 2011 by a Polish cardinal and the Pope's former personal secretary. It's one of just a handful in the world that actually contains the blood of the Polish Pope, who died back in 2005 and, of course, was succeeded by Benedict XVI. Now, who knows what's actually going on there? Maybe everything, maybe nothing. Maybe it's been taken by vampires who were seeking the blood of a pope, or Satanists. Who knows? It's mind-bending, isn't it? Oh, goodness. It's not the only mind-bending story, though, that we've been confronted with this week. Some of you have probably heard that Sir Stephen Hawking is in the news yet again. You know, I've always found him very interesting. And in truth, I have to admire the guy, because despite his physical predisposition, he is still able to author scientific papers. His latest is titled Information Preservation and Weather Forecasting for Black Holes, in which he has actually argued that maybe black holes don't really exist at all, at least not in the way that we have currently scientifically tried to perceive them. Now, Hawking proposes in the paper that black holes maybe can exist without what are called event horizons, or singularities, the invisible cover believed to surround every black hole. During a previous lecture, Into the Void, or rather Into the Black Hole, I guess a black hole is kind of a void, isn't it? Hawking described an event horizon as the boundary of a black hole, where gravity is just strong enough to drag light back and prevent it from escaping. Now, falling through the event horizon is a bit like going over Niagara Falls in a canoe. Hey, that's an analogy I think we can all get behind. Or in front of. Now, if you're above the falls, you can get away if you paddle fast enough, but once you're over the edge, you're lost. There's just no way back, and that's the best description I can give you for an event horizon. Because as you get nearer to the edge of the falls itself, the current gets faster, and this means it pulls harder on the front of the canoe rather than on the back. There's a danger that the canoe will, of course, be pulled apart, and it's the very same when you may be entering a black hole, in theory at least. So Hawking is proposing, apparently, that there are horizons that could exist instead, apparent horizons, in fact, which would only hold light and information for a finite period of time, before releasing them back into space in garbled form. The internationally renowned theoretical physicist has suggested that quantum mechanics and general relativity do remain intact, but that black holes do not have an event horizon to catch fire. You know, this has been one of the long-standing questions, and this is something that scientists, of course, have attempted to do. If you remember reading in Carl Sagan's book, The Demon-Haunted World, and it's a book that I have to recommend to anyone who has interest in the paranormal. And a friend and I were talking about it recently, and I decided to get it back out and had been reading it a bit myself. And, of course, he's talking about, throughout that book, how essentially quantum theory breaks down aspects of Newtonian physics that are consistent in the world in which we occupy and where we observe our surroundings physically around us, but that on that quantum level, things do get a little different, a little stranger. And so when we try to understand black holes, and we try to understand the mysteries of our universe on this level, it doesn't necessarily break down our understanding of the physics of the universe, or relativity theory, as proposed by Albert Einstein, but what it does is it certainly challenges us to be able to maintain the predictions that have been set forth with theories such as general relativity. It's very interesting as we get into this. And again, Hawking is one of many who are trying to address what they call the black hole firewall paradox. It was first discovered by theoretical physicist Joseph Polinsky and his colleagues just a few years ago, when he and his team began investigating what would happen to an astronaut, hypothetically, of course, if this person fell into a black hole. Now, what they guessed was that, rather than being ripped apart by gravitational forces, that the event horizon would be transformed into a highly energetic region, and anyone who fell into it would hit a wall of fire and literally burn to death in an instant. And when we're talking about highly energetic region, we are talking about, I mean, all-consuming flame. But this did actually violate Albert Einstein's theory of relativity, which is interesting for anyone who likes to read about physics, and I certainly do. So in his paper, Hawking writes, "The absence of event horizons means that there are actually no black holes, as we might call them, in the sense of regimes from which light can't escape to affinity. There's no escape from a black hole in classical theory, but quantum theory, however, enables energy and information to escape from a black hole." So it's going to be interesting how this one comes about. I've already been seeing all the pundits and all the papers fighting back and forth about whether or not Hawking is right. And a lot of people have contested him. I think his work is brilliant, frankly. I loved In a Brief History of Time, which has been in print for years, decades now. But in that book, toward the end, he's talking about the thermodynamic arrow of time. And if you apply that, hypothetically, to so much of what we view in the world around us and perceive as being quote-unquote paranormal, to me it starts to make a lot of sense. A friend of mine brought up recently, they said, you know, I just have absolutely no interest in ghosts and ghost hunting and all the pseudoscience of ghost hunting. And I said, well, I agree with you. In fact, I think in large part, people going around carrying meters around and a bunch of technological devices that they know very little about the actual function of i.e. having used them in the field for their designed purpose rather than going around looking for ghosts, an unquantifiable but presumably energetic manifestation of what? A human soul? You know, the essence of a person's thought, form, or being. Yeah, what is a ghost? We don't know enough about that aside from the cultural interpretation of some part of an individual that exists apparently in apparitional form beyond the existent or physical person, i.e. after death. And knowing so little as what we know about ghosts, how can we employ a device that, of course, is calibrated for detecting electromagnetic radiation leaking from microwave ovens or from fluorescent light bulbs or something like that, and hope to employ that to find the presumed, again, I say the presumed energetic manifestation of what we would culturally call a ghost, or mythologically call a ghost, an apparition, a specter, a spirit, a form, a shade. Doesn't really make a lot of sense to me. And this is coming from a background of having spent a lot of time in years past around ghost hunters and watching them employ quote-unquote science in what they're trying to do. Now bring Stephen Hawking back into this. And Hawking talks about what he calls the thermodynamic arrow of time, and essentially how the way that we create memory in our brain, the way our brains function, memories are created, but in accordance with the directional flow. I'm putting up the air quotes there. The direction, as it were, of entropy. In other words, we operate, we function, both in our living and also in the memory function created within the brain, in the same direction in which entropy increases. Which is why we remember the past, but we don't conceptualize what we might call memories of the future. Now, as a brief aside, of course, there are people who have claimed for years and years that they have psychic impressions and can predict things that happen in the future. I'm always a little skeptical of people who claim that they have, you know, a reliable success rate of being able to predict the future, i.e. a soothsayer, a psychic, you know, something like that. But then again, I've also heard some very credible reports of people who have claimed that they have had premonitions. And so supposing for just a moment that a person maybe, according to science of the universe and the human body that we don't yet understand, if a person could indeed have premonitions of future events as yet to have transpired in our space-time reality, i.e. the present, could it be that this is something that is a temporary breakdown in entropic laws that essentially allows what, rather than a prediction, I would call a memory of the future? I hope you follow me there. Now, but this is what's interesting, is that if indeed we create memories and that we process information in the same order in which entropy increases, trending toward chaos, of course, entropy being a measure of essentially heat loss within a system, it's very telling to me that just as we remember the past, I can remember my third or fourth birthday, or I can remember my first date, or I can remember my first pet, or I can remember visiting my grandmother at her house when she was, well, I was a child and she was wonderful, always. But I can remember those things. I couldn't remember what happened tomorrow due to the way that I exist in this, what my friend Scotty Roberts has called, the entropic zone. Isn't it telling that reports of spirits, specters, haunts, and ghosts also are interpreted as being something that hails from the past? In other words, although there may not be a physical explanation for an manifestation that's occurring there, which is why I'm hesitant to call ghosts what a lot of researchers have tried to call them, i.e. a manifestation, some sort of a physical form capable possibly of interacting with the environment temporarily and all this stuff. I couldn't tell you that that's happening, but it is interesting to me, without affirming belief in, condoning or condemning one's views toward the belief of ghosts, it is interesting that, much like the function of memory, the apparent presence of a ghost being something from the past also seems to be, at very least within these set of criteria, in keeping with entropic forces. I hope that makes sense. Not all entropic forces, obviously, because again, if we start getting into the realm of manifestations, energetic potential, there's no way that we can presume that, at least according to our known science, that an apparitional form existent apart from what was once a living body can manifest like that. But it's food for thought. And that came to mind. And in my book, The UFO Singularity, I furthermore get a little into interpreting that in relation to artificial intelligence and computers. That's really more what that book's about. I do kind of color it with something of a ufological lens in the sense of the way that advanced aviation, maybe already existent, will be colored by future technologies, especially artificial intelligence. Some of you may have heard this story this week, in fact, that this company, I believe, I've got the name of it here someplace if I can get my page to load. The page is called DeepMind. They've been acquired by Google. Very interesting. Google keeps buying up interesting projects. And with little doubt, they have taken serious interest in artificial intelligence. I have too. And whether you want to relate it to anything, aerial technologies or thermodynamics for that matter, it's very interesting. And I recommend anyone who wants to try and understand essentially the function of entropy and how that affects the creation of memory stored in a system, whether it be a human brain or a computer, you should read A Brief History of Time by Stephen Hawking, a fascinating book indeed. When we come back, speaking of fascinating, there's been some stuff going on in the news, truly a, I would call it a scandalous, a sensational story, and something on par with what you might expect to see in a film by William Peter Blatty. Maybe you know what I'm talking about already. Yes, indeed, this is an alleged case of demonic possession, but people are claiming that this one has had a lot of information behind it to substantiate the claims. We'll find out about that when we come back here on the Graylian Report. Stay with us.
On the battlefield, there's a saying America's military men and women live by. Never leave a fallen warrior behind, ever. Off the battlefield, Wounded Warrior Project operates with the same goal. Wounded Warrior Project was created to help our men and women returning home with the scars of war, whether those scars are physical or mental. Wounded Warrior Project. We never leave a fallen warrior behind, ever. Learn more about what we do at woundedwarriorproject.org.
Welcome back to the program. It is the Graylian Report, keeping you company every Tuesday night from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern. We're about to get into a little exorcism, but I want to talk about this very, very briefly. You're hearing the sounds of Above the Sky, a song by a buddy of mine named Luke from Australia. Hope to hear a few more of their tunes on the program in the future. And of course, if you've got music you'd like to submit for comeback tunes here on Graylian Report, just email me info@graylianreport.com. That's right, that email comes directly to me. That's how you can do it. Some good sounding stuff there, huh? Anyhow, their group's called Lawsome, and I'm sure, again, we'll be hearing more from them in the future. Now, speaking of the future or the past, and a funny anecdote I wanted to add, by the way, as we were talking about the potential for so-called memories from the future in the last segment, you know, when I first met Eric Von Daniken, love him or hate him, agree with him, disagree, you know, I'm not so much a proponent necessarily of paleo contact, as Carl Sagan called it, or ancient alien theory as it is known today. Von Daniken would have called them ancient astronauts, but one of the first things he mentioned to me, and I don't know how it came up in conversation, but I mentioned that expression, memories from the future, and he says, that was the original title of my book. And he was talking about Chariots of the Gods, but apparently the publishers didn't like Chariots of the Gods, or they didn't like Memories from the Future. Although I think that in some editions, Chariots of the Gods may have nonetheless borne a subtitle that was along those lines. Very interesting. All the little dovetails and parallels. Now, this story that we're about to get into is a little disturbing. And I know that the Graylian Report is generally a family-friendly program. It will remain such. But this story certainly has some rather interesting facets that that get a little complex at times. And in particular, this has to do with an exorcism, allegedly, that was taking place. And, of course, children who were allegedly victims of demonic possession. The funny thing about this story is I've just been seeing the tabloids going nuts over this. The Gannett-owned Indy Star, I think, carried the longest rendition, but I think that the Telegraph in the UK has touched on this. The Blaze News Network has talked about this just as well. I mean, everyone is talking about it. And to have so many spiritual and paranormal overtones, to see people in the mainstream reporting on this story so matter-of-factly, is in itself, to me, incredibly, incredibly unique. But I have some concerns about this story, because, you know, I'm a person, I was raised in a Christian home. And I have even studied the literature pertaining to the rite of exorcism, as it is known. Popularized, of course, in Hollywood films, such as The Exorcism of Emily Rose, and before that, more famously, The Exorcist, where little Reagan hovered over the bed and vomited split pea soup and all kinds of things. So, now, this latest allegation of exorcism takes place in the home of a woman. She was only in her early 30s, three children, and they claimed that they were all possessed by demons that haunted the house that seemed to emanate, get this, just like out of a horror film, from the staircase below the home in the basement. Apparently in that basement there were concrete floors, but the concrete was broken beneath these stairs, and so it had even been suggested at some point that maybe there had been bodies buried there. It's a strange, strange story, but again, what makes it probably so interesting is the fact that there are many organizations that ended up having to get involved, the DCS personnel in the locality, psychologists, doctors, police, who were admittedly afraid to even stay around the property of the house after nightfall based on what they had seen. And as I understand, there were a few police in the area, including the Gary was the name of the area, but the Gary police captain, Charles Austin, he had referred to it as, quote, the strangest story he'd ever heard, and a number of other officers who had visited the house had taken personal interest in this case. Now, whatever the cause of these occurrences that befell the family of one Latoya Ammons, we don't know. It's everything has been suggested, from literal demonic possession to psychological disorders. But it, whatever it is, was indeed very, very strange. Now, there were apparently 800 pages of official records kept about this case. These included police reports, Department of Child Services reports. They were obtained by the Indianapolis Star. And they talked about how the family was apparently tortured in the spiritual sense, and at times in the physical sense, by this apparent demonic presence. This story, strangely, is one that they say starts with flies, because, you know, you hear about the plagues and the legends associated with the appearance of flies. Well, it was December, and Latoya Ammons had claimed that there in her home, despite it being the cold season, there were flies, and there were a number of other things that were showing up just as well.
There was like horse flies on the inside porch, and this was, you know, the beginning of winter, so that was very odd to me. We would lock the basement door, and you would hear something hit the door. Boom! And you would hear dogs barking. No dogs outside. No dogs. We would go look. No dogs.
They claimed that they would hear the dogs barking but never be able to see them, and often after midnight they would hear the steady clump of footsteps that they said seemed to be climbing from up the basement stairs, and then they would hear the creak of the door opening, leading into the kitchen, but they never found anyone there. Although, in a few instances they did actually see, Latoya especially claimed to have seen, the manifestation of an entity in her home. Literally a man, she said, that appeared to come out of a closet.
And I saw one, like, coming into full image. It was coming out of my closet. I've never seen it like that before. I would see the shadows, you know, but I've never seen it like how I'm looking at you and you're looking at me.
Now, maybe one of the more disturbing allegations in this case took place in the middle of the night. Now, apparently, the story goes that Ammons and a family friend and her children had apparently been mourning the death of a loved one with a group of friends. It was about 2 a.m. on this occasion when Amon's startled everyone by screaming. This would have been one of her children, by the way. So, apparently Miss Campbell, who had been housing the children that night, ran into the bedroom, where her then 12-year-old granddaughter and a friend were staying, and it is said that the 12-year-old was levitating above the bed, unconscious. Now, according to their account, Ammons and several others surrounded the girl, praying. Mrs. Campbell says that she remembers being very terrified, and I thought, she said, what's going on? Why is this happening? But they said eventually that the child descended and rested on the bed again. The girl woke up with no memory of what happened. You know, often in alleged cases of demonic possession, people have said that they've seen particularly children levitate above the bed like this. John Keel recounted this, of course, in his book The Eighth Tower. Now, I wonder if there are indeed any truly reliable reports where this has been more than just observed. Not necessarily just to challenge the observation, but, I mean, how physically can something be levitated off of a bed? Hence, of course, the obvious insinuation of some sort of demonic presence. Who knows? So they began to get the family more and more disturbed by these apparent instances. They contacted a number of local churches. They talked to their landlord, but their landlord didn't seem to be very open to what was transpiring, at least at first. Their landlord, Charles Reed, eventually began to take into consideration that others were seeing what was happening and not just his tenants, but initially he had been concerned that maybe they were telling a story just to be able to try and get out of having to pay the rent.
Latoya took me inside the house and showed me different stuff. I didn't see anything that was relevant to what she said, even though other people did, so I was very skeptical. I just figured she owed me money and this is a fabricated story. And that's not strange to my walk of life. That does happen, you know. Like I said, I thought I heard it all. This is new one to me. There's five people that saw this happen, and they're, you know, different walks of life. That does change things a little bit. I have a hard to believe that all five of those people will say this just to be saying it.
Now, apparently, Ammons and her family had hoped to try and seek the help of local churches. Most would not entertain the stories of the alleged haunting or possession. But one church finally told them that maybe they had spirits in it and that they could possibly cleanse the home. And apparently the cleansing mechanism was rather unconventional. The first recommendation had been to use bleach and ammonia to clean the house. Never heard that one with regard to a demonic possession before, have you? But then, more traditionally, oil could also be used, they said, to draw crosses on every door and window, as well as for use in blessing the children. So Ammon said she poured olive oil on her three children's hands and feet and then smeared oil in the shape of crosses also on their foreheads, which in the Catholic tradition is often referred to as the sacrament of holy unction when administered by a priest. So Campbell and Ammons also told the Star that they had reached out to two clairvoyants seeking help just as well, one of whom told them that the family was besieged by more than 200 demons. I'm glad somebody was keeping count. They were told that the best thing that they could do was to move. Ammons remembered the clairvoyants telling her, but that wasn't an option because they didn't have a whole lot of money. Now, at this point, as a brief aside, I have to point out this reminds me so much of a story that I personally was involved with a few years ago. What happened was I was contacted by a UFO investigator in this region of Western North Carolina where I live. And the man had told me that there were dear people, friends of his, that needed help. Well, I'm never one to allow folks who are in genuine need to go unaided. And so I agreed to come and to meet these people with this gentleman. And my girlfriend at the time and I, the girlfriend actually, it's interesting to note, went on to be somewhat involved in paranormal investigation. Her name is Antonia, and some folks who follow the paranormal may know her. She goes by the name publicly Antonia Eden, and I think she shares my views about a lot of this stuff due to her own experiences with some of the crazies out there in the ghost hunting world, but that's another discussion altogether. And so Antonia and I went and we met this gentleman and these folks at their house. And their story was that basically, as a result of a a condition that was called extreme hypersensitivity and multiple allergy. One of the two women that lived on the site could not live in a house that was made of wood, because if the wood were ever to get moldy or break down, it absolutely would kill her. And furthermore, she was extremely hypersensitive to electromagnetic fields and all kinds of things like this. So the structure, the primary structure of the home, had been made from metal. And the house was repeatedly, where it sat on top of a hill, being struck by lightning and causing electrical problems, destroying property. They were spending all of their money trying to keep the property intact. Well, it was pretty obvious to me that if you've got a great big giant lightning rod sitting on top of a hill in western North Carolina, it's going to get struck by lightning. And furthermore, the way that the land had been, I guess, cultivated, well, actually, in the absence of any cultivation, it was just basically just kind of grass growing all over this hill. They'd had a lot of trouble with erosion because there weren't any bushes or shrubs or anything like that really to kind of catch the water. And if it really got to raining, it was literally tearing apart parts of the hill. And so they were really distressed because they said, it's like God has just said, nope, you're not going to live here. Well, my associate who had called me out, he called me out because of my interests that he knew I had in the unexplained. And he proceeded to tell the two women that they were being besieged, according to what a psychic had told him, by an ancient disembodied extraterrestrial entity that was somewhere on the property, and that this thing wanted them gone. And he said, I don't know how to tell you this, but you have got to leave. And I remember sitting there with a sick feeling in my stomach, watching this person, who really meant well, but watching him tell these people, you've got to go. And so as one of the two women walked me out to my car, Antonia and I said to her, I put my hand on her shoulder and I said, listen, I can't make decisions for you, but based on what you just heard in there, I want you to know, don't believe everything that you hear. And that was all I said. I tried to call her back after the fact. She didn't return the phone calls. And for God's sake, she probably thought I was one of these crazies. But this is, I tell you this story to illustrate how potentially dangerous it can be at times if you are not wary when you choose your beliefs. You have to be very discriminating when it comes to what beliefs you allow into your worldview, because some of them, I think, can be dangerous and, frankly, delusional. And this is where I think necessary skepticism comes into question. It's okay also to be open-minded, especially when you are presented with an apparent phenomenon that you cannot understand. And hence why I've often referred to myself as being skeptical. I think some of the best researchers, though, have called themselves skeptics. John Keel often called himself the skeptic. And Dr. Robert Schock recently had pointed out, and he even referenced my own talks about skepticism. He said, I'm skeptical of everything. And he says, and you should be. And he says that it's good to be skeptical, like Micah has said that we should. Because if you're not at least a little discriminating, you do, I think, run the risk of letting certain damaging facets of the world around us into your worldview. And I worry about things like this, what we're reading here in the Indianapolis Star, where psychics or clairvoyants, as they were referred to here, not attack against people who claimed to be able to have the gift, so to speak. But these people told this family that their home was besieged by 200 demons. You know, if it were a real demonic possession, wouldn't just one be capable of getting the job done? Why the hell, no pun intended, do we have to say that there are 200 demons? Again, I'm glad somebody's keeping count. We'll finish this up on the next side of the break so that we can maintain continuity. But, you know, think about some of this, because, you know, again, I think that maybe at the heart of this family really felt like something was happening to them. And yet, you also begin to see certain elements that are disturbing for other reasons just as well. But the really good stuff is yet to come. And some of it, this even made me wonder, because certain aspects of this case really are almost like something that you would expect to hear more from a book or a film. We'll get to that when we come back. I'm Micah Hanks. Stay with us.
mountains of Appalachia. It's the Graylian Report with Micah Hanks. To join the program by phone, call 828-398-4886. Skype users can reach the program by calling Skype ID Graylian Report. And now, from hundreds of miles beneath terra firma, in the depths of the hollow earth, live from the Graylian Bunker, it's Micah Hanks.
Thank you, John Anderson. We're hearing a little of the sounds of Blake Germain and his project Tall Fields here. Always good to feature real talent. And there's a lot of it out there on the interwebs. Folks in the chat room were asking, are my bands available online? One of them you can certainly find, and that is Nitrograss at nitrograss.com. And that's not something you smoke. We're talking about a regionally indigenous variety of music here in the southern United States known as bluegrass, although we do a lot of alt-country just as well. But speaking of alternatives, coming back to this story, again, it's a very strange one. The family besieged by 200 demons, according to clairvoyants that they had spoken with. They said that a number of strange things had been happening in the house. They literally had been prompted to carry out rituals where they donned big white t-shirts and wrapped white scarves around their heads, lit candles, and read psalms. Specifically, Psalm 91, you may remember it. You will not fear the terror of night, nor the arrow that flies by day, nor the pestilence that stalks in the darkness, nor the plague that destroys at midday. But things apparently only got worse after this. Now, as this situation got more and more out of control, you've got to keep in mind that Latoya Ammons had three children, ages 7, 9, and 12. She claimed that her children's eyes were bulging, that they had evil smiles that crossed their faces. They threatened to kill one another in voices that deepened unnaturally. She was so terrified and concerned about this, so eventually the 12-year-old, all the children, in fact, were taken before mental health professionals, but the 12-year-old would tell them that she had sometimes felt as if she were being choked and held down so that she couldn't speak or move. She said she'd even heard a voice tell her that she'd never see her family again and that she wouldn't live another 20 minutes. Truly, truly horrific. Events like these had led the family to have to stay in hotels. But finally, out of desperation, they went to their family physician, Dr. Jeffrey Onowuku, back in 2012. Ammons told their physician that they were going through a lot of trouble and hoped that he might understand. Now, of course, being a man of science, he called it bizarre and said that, quote, in 20 years I'd never heard anything like that in my life, but that he himself had been scared when he walked into the room after going to their house. He wouldn't speak any more about this to reporters until psychiatric clearance was provided by Ammons herself, but she believes so strongly in the story that she tells that she maintains it's all true and has allowed all the gritty details in these reports aforementioned, including the DCS report, to be revealed to the public so that they can literally discuss this. Now, Onowuku, the family physician, had written, of course, in his notes, that there had been, quote, delusions of a ghost in the home, and that perhaps they'd been experiencing hallucinations. Well, eventually, the situation got to a point where the children had to be taken to a medical hospital. And it was at the hospital that the truly strange things began to happen. One of the boys, the older boy, at the time, 9 years old, had apparently acted rationally, but the youngest child had been screaming and thrashing. He had apparently started growling with his teeth showing, and they said that his eyes rolled back into his head. He locked his hands around his older brother's throat and refused to let go and continued to try and choke him, saying, I will kill you. It's time to die. When the older brother was told this, he began headbutting Campbell in the stomach. So, in an attempt to try and settle the situation, they began to pray, and according to, get this, the original DCS report, this is what is actually said in the report. They said the 9-year-old had been sitting there with a weird grin, and that then when the nurse came over, he walked backward up a wall, clear to the ceiling, and then flipped over, landing on his feet, never letting go of Mrs. Campbell's hands, his grandmother. They say he walked up the wall, flipped over her, and stood there, There's no way he could have done that. Now, police had asked whether the boy had indeed run up the wall, as though performing maybe an acrobatic trick. According to the nurse, she said no. The boy glided backward on the floor, wall and ceiling, and then flipped over in front of his grandmother. Now, this is indeed a strange, strange case. Doctors apparently came into the room afterward and asked the boy, "Can you do that for us again?" They were not in the room when this happened, but apparently the family members and a nurse witnessed this. And this was later referenced in the police reports just as well, who had said that apparently they believed that some evil influence might be affecting the family. But it is important to note that mental health professionals had said that while there may be, quote, some demonic spirit involved, that the majority of it had been the result of some form of mental illness. Well, unfortunately, Ms. Ammons' children were temporarily removed from her custody by DCS. She continued to undergo a number of problems just as well. And finally, she came into contact with a priest in the area, Reverend Michael Magineau, who agreed to perform an exorcism. But apparently there wasn't just one exorcism. He had had to go through, not one, not two, as I understand, three exorcisms, attempts at exorcisms, in order to try and relieve the woman of her affliction, the spiritual affliction. He details that for us now.
This boy was in one of the emergency room areas. He was kind of growling, you know, and his grandmother was holding his hands and trying to coax him back. And all of a sudden he started, you know, she was kind of backing him up and toward the wall. And then he started to walk up the wall backwards, did a flip over her head. And then there was the psychologist and the social service worker in that room that saw that, and they ran out and got the security, and the security called the chaplain, and you know, he called me, and they got the police involved and all that. It was pretty much without incident until we get to the part of your name, and you ask for its name. Now, so far, she's always been silent. So, and I says, "Is your name whatever?"
Now, at this point, I want to point out that when he's talking about "it is your name," he had gone apparently through a list of different demons. Remember, keeping in mind that the clairvoyance on hand had said that there were 200 of them besieging the home of Latoya Ammons and her children. And they had gone through a list that they had found apparently online of demons, one of them being Beelzebub. You may know that name. And in addition to Beelzebub, also there were spirits or demonic entities believed to particularly attack and accost children in the spiritual sense. When praying over Latoya, he said that she was calm, but that she too would begin to thrash and convulse when they began to attack the presumed, by name, demonic entities.
She started convulsing and such. So now once you have a name, you kind of attack it. You try everything, you know, you kind of go through the whole rite to see which things push the buttons of, you know, the entity. And once you found what does it, you keep on using it over and over. Whenever you would praise God in Latin, no reaction. But you start condemning the demon, you know, condemning, you know, the evil spirit, you know, all of a sudden she's reacting to that. And then you will go back, and the moment you go back to praising God, she would stop reacting. So I went through the whole rite, and then finally went the second time, you know, and then it was just like just focusing on the condemnations part. And that was kind of riling up. I think I even went a third time. But you could tell it was kind of weakening, and then eventually she fell asleep again.
And apparently upon falling asleep, Latoya Ammons ceased to be afflicted, she says, by this apparent demonic presence. Shortly thereafter, I believe that she and her mother had gone and had to live in Chicago for a while. But shortly thereafter, she obtained custody of her children again. Said it was the best day of her life, of course. And all was well. But the strange aspects of this case, especially the child running backwards up the wall, and all of these, they do make it very interesting. And I guess maybe with good reason, according to, and what makes this a singular case, especially, is not just the allegations contained within, but the official reports from the police, the Department of Child Services, all these different areas, the medical reports, in fact, even, that her family physician had allowed, or ultimately it was LaToya Ammons who had to acknowledge the release of these things, and she did. But all of these different reports seem to coincide. They all seem to point to there being the belief among this the members of this community that something had been going on. Now, the family no longer lives in the house. But get this. You remember I told you that there had been police officers. At one point, they'd even accompanied Reverend Magano to the property where one of them had been asked to dig a small hole beneath the stairs because there seemed to be this problem emanating from the stairs. They'd found, you know, articles of clothing, things like that, probably from previous residents, but no evidence of there being a body under the stairs. They only dug a few feet, though. I mean, traditionally, they say 6 feet under. If they'd gone a little deeper, who knows what they might have found. Who knows? But at the end of the day, they didn't manage to find anything there. The family didn't stay at the house. But the landlord that we mentioned earlier, Charles Reed, had said that they didn't, or he had rather not experienced issues prior to or after the Ammons family residing there. But the police who had been on site and who had been by the home, even after LaToya and her children moved out, continued to patrol the area, and especially just before and after dark, police would show up and they would drive slowly by the house and just keep an eye on things. They had long been, maybe you'd say, professionally interested in the area. So much so that Charles Reed, the landlord, had had to call them and tell them, guys, would you please stop sending police officers by this house? The new tenants are being harassed, or they feel like they're being harassed. They feel like they're afraid. Not of ghosts. They haven't said anything about ghosts, but they say that they don't like the police coming around continually like they seem to be doing. Truly a strange case. We'll have that linked in the show notes if you'd like to read more thoroughly the report of LaToya Ammons and her family. What do you make of that? You know, I will say that some of the health aspects of this and some of the officials involved did believe that it may have had to do more with not mental illness, but perception of phenomenon rather than something that actually exists. We'll leave it at that, and we'll be back right after this on the Graylian Report.
Every day I wake up at 5 to give Dad his medicine. Every day I wake up at 5 to give Dad his medicine. At 6, I make his breakfast. Every day I wake up at 5 to give Dad his medicine. At 6, I make his breakfast. At 7, I shower. Every day I wake up
at 5. For those caring for a loved one, we hear you. That's why AARP created a community to help us better care for ourselves and the ones we love. Visit aarp.org/caregiving. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Confessions of a Potentially Perfect Parent, brought to you by AdoptUsKids.org.
I might look like an adult, like a person who could possibly be a parent, but I have no idea how to talk like one. And everyone knows that if you want to be a parent, you have to sound good when you say things like, "Don't make me turn this car around," or "Because I said so," or "Don't make me come back there." I don't even really know what those things mean, but I know that I actually believed my parents when they said them to me. How did they manage to sound so convincing? Here we go. "Don't make me come back there." Ugh, no, that's not tough enough at all. Kids can sense weakness. "Don't make me come back there." Ooh, yeah, that's better. In fact, that kind of sounded like my dad. Weird.
You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. There are thousands of teens in foster care who would love to listen to you practice your dad voice. Call 1-888-200-4005 or visit AdoptUsKids.org for more information. This message brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt Us Kids, and the Ad Council.
On the battlefield, there's a saying America's military men and women live by: never leave a fallen warrior behind, ever. Off the battlefield, Wounded Warrior Project operates with the same goal. Wounded Warrior Project was created to help our men and women returning home with the scars of war, whether those scars are physical or mental. Wounded Warrior Project: we never leave a fallen warrior behind, ever. Learn more about what we do at WoundedWarriorProject.org.
Unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grillion Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
Welcome back to the program. It is the Grillion Report. I'm your host, Micah Hanks. Normally, on a night like tonight, we would probably be segueing into the presidential address, the State of the Union address, no less, that is about to be delivered by President Obama. However, we have a guest tonight, and therefore it is in good taste and, of course, in keeping with keeping good company that we get to our guest. But I'm sure that we'll probably provide some commentary on that. In fact, we already have, and if you'd like to hear a little of that, just check out MiddleTheory.com, the latest edition of the program, which broadcasts live on Monday nights. We actually got into what is expected to be on the table tonight. I'm going to have to catch the replay, but maybe some of you out there will have one ear listening to us and the other tuned in to Mr. Obama. I know that my cohort in crime, Mr. McNonymous, is there in the chat room, and he'll no doubt be keeping an eye on both for us. And so without further ado, I've been reading for the last few days on the UFO debate. You know, the books that I've been really enjoying in particular have been John Alexander's book on UFOs, in which he essentially brings to the table the idea that there is a lot less going on in government in relation to UFOs, i.e. a secret government group that studies them. He says that there's no evidence of that he's ever found, and a lot less interest in government in general than most people would like to admit. And then one of the other books that it's not necessarily considered a ufological book by any means, but it is a book, I think, at very least, that deals with UFOs in a meaningful way that probably more people should pay attention to. It is a book called The Demon-Haunted World by Carl Sagan. Pairing a couple of interesting books like that, you know, it really leaves a lot of room for questions. And obviously, I think in relation to this subject, there are a few. Now, our guest tonight, Dr. John Hart, is a professor of Christian ethics at Boston University. He has recently published a new book just as of November called Cosmic Commons, Spirit, Science, and Space. This was released by Cascade Books. He joins us now for the first time on the Grillion Report, and I'm very happy to have you with us, Dr. Hart. Good evening.
Hello, it's good to be here, Mike.
Yeah, I'm very glad to have you. And so, you know, we'll get right into things, but I first want to ask you, I know you're up in Boston area, so how's the weather up there? Are you guys getting struck by this polar plunge?
Yes, we are. It's been pretty cold.
Yeah, yes, that's what I was afraid of. And it's been cold down here where I am just as well. So we're in, I guess, good company. Cozy up, have a cup of tea. So let's get to your book. It's called Cosmic Commons, Spirit, Science, and Space. What prompted you to write this book?
Well, I would go back a bit to when I was in college and I saw this. Can you hear me okay?
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay, and I was sitting with some friends on the Hudson River, and I looked up and I saw this bright, fast light that I thought was a meteor, and that I kept waiting for it to fade out. It was the largest, brightest, fastest meteor I'd seen. And then all of a sudden, without any kind of stop or curvature, without banking, it just shot straight up at right angles to itself. And I said to myself, that's impossible. That violates laws of physics. And so I didn't say anything. I was with two friends, and and one of them said they just didn't like the right angles to itself. And I said to the end of the math, I guess they saw a UFO. So that was kind of a remote reason. And then in 2006, I was reading a newspaper article where Stephen Hawking at the Hong Kong University of Science said that we had to get a base on the moon and a colony on Mars in the next 20 years because humankind was destroying the Earth. It's going to happen by nuclear war or biochemical warfare or pollution or whatever else, overpopulation. And it struck me as soon as I read that quote from him, it's the same people. We're going to be sending up in this base people coming from the same species that has been destroying its own home and habitat. And how would we expect anything different to happen when humankind, if the same human beings are traveling to space without having a change in their consciousness as to how they would treat the environment, how they would treat other people who are different from themselves?
Yes, those are important points that I think I've heard Stephen Hawking mention many times in the past. And, you know, it's hard not to look at this in the cosmic sense of the equation, but I'm fascinated to hear that what primarily, I guess, inspired you to write a book was this experience in 1963. So what do you think that was? I mean, were you dealing with something natural? Were you dealing with something extraordinary or even extraterrestrial? How did you perceive that experience?
Well, when I saw that light over the river, at first I thought it was a meteor, so it seemed to be a natural meteorological phenomenon. And then when I shot at right angles, I realized this was not anything that could happen to a meteor by itself, that it had to be controlled. And that's why that was my first realization. Later on, I found out that there had been hundreds of sightings over the Hudson River during that period, and thousands later on, roughly, I guess, 20 years later. So it became to be a regular thing in the Hudson River, and that, you know, there were photographs taken. And Dr. Alan Hynek, the astrophysicist who was hired by the Air Force to be their scientific consultant, he went into his own investigation there, and he was amazed at the number of what he calls credible witnesses came forward, IBM executives, aeronautical engineers, professional people who ordinarily might be afraid of employment repercussions or just being ridiculed by others. But he said so many people saw this that people were more comfortable in coming out and acknowledging and telling their story and where they saw and so forth. And I think that comfort level helps people out, because the U.S. government has used ridicule or denial to say that there's no such thing as extraterrestrial intelligence or unidentified flying objects that are intelligently controlled. And it's carried over into the professions, too, where people in universities are afraid to even mention this topic for fear their colleagues will look at them and think there's something wrong with them because they accept the possibility that there's extraterrestrial intelligence.
Right. Have you encountered that yourself, John? Have you, as a professor in Boston, do you have that issue where your colleagues go, oh, you know, he's just out there?
In a sense, I've given talks on campus, and sometimes people, typical of what Hynek also report, kind of roll their eyes, you know, here we go again, or but then I was at a casual meeting of faculty. This was about 3 years ago. It was one of the provosts held these kind of sessions to get faculty from across the university to, he called the provostial meet and greet. And it's just whoever was sitting at a particular table, and there were four of us, two were very senior scientists. I'm guessing they were in their mid-70s, and they had each been there at BU, Ross University, 40 years or so. And then there was a history professor, and she had been there a short time, and then myself. And we talked about what we're going to do in May. What are you going to be doing this summer? And I said, well, I've been working on a book and putting together a course called Encountering ETI. And the two scientists looked at me and laughed, and they said, no, that's so ridiculous. How could you possibly pursue that, you know, as an academic subject? So I told them about what happened to me as a GE in college. And then the history professor said, well, she said, I have, listen to all the credentials here. I have a conservative Christian Republican aunt who's a farmer in Kansas. And she looked out one day of her kitchen window while she was doing dishes, and she saw a UFO land out in her fields. And she said she tells very few people because she's afraid she'll be ridiculed by, especially in a rural area, small town, and so forth. So she only told a handful of close family that she had seen this. And so now there were two of us. I had seen the Hudson River UFO, and her aunt had seen an actual landing out in her farm. And then, interesting, one of the scientists who had been just ridiculing it before said, well, he said, okay, I have to tell you something. He said, I was a spotter for the Air Force in 1953 on the coast of Maine, and I was watching for, you know, a possible invasion by the USSR. They were worried about planes crossing and attacking the U.S., you know, during the height of the Cold War. And he said, I saw these four craft coming at very high speed in formation. And, of course, he said, I know all of our planes, and I know all the Russians, he said. And I knew it didn't belong to either one of us. And so I called back to the base, and I said, I've got these four craft coming at very high speed. And they said, well, is it one of the Russians? He said, no. And they said, one of ours. And then, well, we see nothing on radar. And he said, okay. So and then they came in faster and almost overhead. And he called again. He said, do you have anything on radar yet? And I said, no. Are you sure it's not the Russians and it's not ours? And he got kind of exasperated. Well, I wouldn't be out here as a spotter if I didn't know what the Russians' planes look like and what ours look like. And they said, well, we'll get back to you. And he said, about 10 minutes later, they called him back and said, you did not see anything. Repeat, you did not see anything.
Oh.
And he said, well, he said, I knew what that meant, so I haven't said anything in all these years. And it was kind of funny watching his colleagues' reaction. I mean, if they had been friends for, you know, 40 years and both senior research professors. And he said, you never told me that. And he said, yeah, he said, but since other people were talking about it, I thought I'd mention that too. So the other guy who had been laughing before this, well, I got to think about this a bit more seriously now that the three of you, I'm the only one that hasn't had some sort of experience. And that was good too. I mean, he showed if someone he was familiar with, like his colleague and friend, had said that he had seen something, well, it makes it more credible. And one of the hopes I expressed in the book is that some people have seen something like this. It might take somebody very confident in telling about it if you're afraid of getting ridiculed, again, even by your own family. So that's why I advise people. I had my book found, just a draft copy of it, in Montana, and the young man, I guess he was about in his 20s, who was binding it, just a spiral binding, and he said, what's it about? And I told him, he says, well, he says, when I was in my parents' house out on the porch in the country, this is Montana, and he said, one night I was looking at and I saw these lights doing all kinds of, I mean, they were flying in zigzags and so forth, and he said, I knew that was, it had to be, you know, intelligently controlled, but I never told anybody. I told my parents, and they said, don't tell anybody else, because they were afraid he's going to be ridiculed if people thought he was being serious about what he said he saw. So I know there are a number of people, even research scientists, and Dr. Hynek talks about this in his books too, who are afraid of lack of professional advancement, even getting fired, and so forth. There's such a constraint on it. This is not an academic subject. In fact, I had an email from a professor at Oxford asking me, do I think this is an academic subject worthy of investigation? So I sent him back by email a lengthy list of reasons why I thought it was. And there's so many reports about that people, scientists, I would imagine, would be excited if they were able to get research funds to be able to do an independent, objective investigation. And there might well be some going on now that they could not be afraid of publishing publicly. So people would, then maybe the stories would spread around more and people would feel more confident that they wouldn't be ridiculed and that others share similar experiences.
Yeah, and you know, and I feel, John, like in addition to there being the fear of the ridicule factor, that also I think that if you're sitting in a room full of people who are dismissive of the subject, I think psychologically, even the brightest among us might go, gosh, you know, and they maybe would second-guess their own experience, you know, and it's not so much that they're necessarily afraid of talking about it, but they may actually think, you know, this whatever I think I saw just didn't conform to the reality, the consensus reality that we all share. Maybe I didn't have that experience myself. Had you ever, with your own experience, doubted what you saw in 1963?
Never. I mean, I think if you've seen a dramatic event like that, and if you've, maybe especially if you studied science as I have, and you know, I said my first thought was that's impossible. It violates laws of physics. It would shatter if it tried to change directions without changing speed, if not only fast rate and just going at right angles. It just, you know, the momentum would want to carry it forward, and all of a sudden it goes against that. It just, anything that we know of would shatter. So it's just like an ordinary rule of physics at the time. And I began thinking later on that also what we do is we judge things based on our own knowledge. Like scientists would say, well, show me the proof. It's such a vast difference between Earth and the nearest galaxy, and it would take generations to traverse the space and so forth. And now I think, well, according to the physics and the technology we have, we don't know about things like other dimensions, or I don't know very much about wormholes or what they could possibly mean, but people, especially, well, Earth is around 4.5 billion years old, and the universe is about 14.8 billion. So it's more than three times the age of the Earth. So assuming that if the conditions are right, then life can develop elsewhere, and that it might evolve into intelligent life, it just seems like it's pretty high probability. And that's what Hawking said. He said we should also avoid contact because if they're traveling through space, they probably destroy their planet like we're destroying ours. So kind of an anthropomorphic projection. Well, since we're destroying Earth, other intelligent beings must have done the same thing to their planet. So we got to make sure they don't contact us. We should shut down SETI because we don't want them to know we're here because they might just try to take over our territory as well. So he said, according to my mathematical mind, there's a very high probability. In a similar way, kind of on a different perspective, the Jesuit priest at the head of the Vatican Observatory was interviewed, I guess that was probably about 4 years or so ago, and the reporter asked him, what do you think about the possibility of there being extraterrestrial intelligent life? And he said, yeah, he says, it seems very likely that it is, and in fact, it's probably much more intelligent than we are. And the reporter was kind of taken aback because that's quite the answer he expected to hear. And he said, well, if we interact with them, how should we respond to them? And Gabriel Funes, the priest, said, well, he said, I think St. Francis, who talks about all creatures being brothers and sisters and even the sun and the moon and so forth, that we can do no less if we meet other intelligent beings to be open to them as other intelligent species who in many ways might be like us, and so we try to treat them with respect and hope they'll do likewise.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's the perfect approach to take, to treat them as we would treat our own, or more importantly, as we would hope to be treated ourselves. Dr. John Hart is our guest, and his book is Cosmic Commons, Spirit, Science, and Space. And when we come back from this break, we're going to be talking more with him about this book. I tell you, it's fascinating. I want to get into some of his scientific background, how that has influenced his thought process in relation to his study of UFOs, and also a little bit about something we might call discovery doctrine. It's no doubt going to be an interesting discussion for the remainder of the hour. I'm your host, as always, Micah Hanks, and this is the Grayling Report. We'll be back right after this, so don't go anywhere.
Imagine no longer being tied down to your computer, but having the freedom to take live talk radio with you anywhere you go. TalkStream Live introduces our first ever iPhone application. The talk shows you follow now follow you, and your iPhone is now the fastest and easiest way to stay connected to the best talk radio on the internet. Let TalkStream Live transform the way you listen to radio. Listen to live talk shows 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Mobile talk radio from TalkStream Live. Now available in the iTunes App Store.
From the high mountains of Appalachia, welcome back to the program. It is the Grayling Report, where we broadcast every week from 8 to 10 p.m. on Tuesday nights, East Coast time, but around the globe on the internet, and of course, any time of day, any place you may be, on or off planet, as long as you've got access to iTunes. So be sure and spread the good word about our operations, what we do, how we do it, and why we do it, because it's important to get this kind of information out to folks. A rational perspective on all things esoteric, as we like to provide for you. And we're certainly doing that tonight as we're discussing the book Cosmic Commons with our guest, Dr. John Hart. You know, this is a fascinating subject, and I don't think that there's any way really to get around it. When you're talking about UFOs, you're going to have to get a little bit into the discussion of, well, you know, what motivates you to want to study this? And, of course, what are the problems with trying to present this to an academic audience? We've talked about that just a little bit. And before we get into the idea of discovery doctrine, John, I wanted to ask you, some of your own scientific training I know has been instrumental in your worldview and also, of course, your, the theories that you formulate and put forth in your book. Let's talk about that a little.
Well, I really became interested in science when I was in high school. Actually, before that, my favorite form of fiction was science fiction. So I was kind of thinking about those kinds of things. And then I remember I was a junior in high school. I saw this great article. It was either Look or Life magazine by William O. Fowler, who was an astrophysicist at UCLA. And I actually wrote some. The article was called The Origins of the Universe and all these beautiful graphics. And I thought to myself, well, I'd like to be an astrophysicist. And so I wrote him a letter asking about the programs at UCLA, and he actually wrote back and said, well, I could consider that seriously. And but then in my senior year, I started thinking more in direction toward the humanities, and so that's what I ended up pursuing. But I've never lost my interest in science. I've been involved in what's called the science-religion dialogue, as people are meeting, trying to think about ways of making science and religion work together and not be the enemy that they're stereotyped into being, which is not actually what's happening. That's kind of basically the background. I didn't pursue a degree, but I have stayed interested and read articles and so forth, and trying to think again about ways of how do people who think there's an incompatibility between them, how can they work out and have this mutual respect? I think it's significant change in that regard took place a few years ago when Carl Sagan, who was an atheist, and Neil Wilson, a Harvard biologist, and others decided that religion could work well with science in trying to address ecological issues. And then Wilson, in 2006, wrote his book, The Creation, An Appeal to Save Life on Earth, in which he talks, it's a letter to a kind of a generic Southern Baptist pastor. Wilson grew up in the Southern Baptist tradition in the South. And when he was a young man, he was given a choice by his pastor. You can either believe in Charles Darwin or believe in Jesus Christ. And well, since he had been doing studies on his own evolution, everything seemed very logical to him. He decided that he'd follow that path. Since he was given that stark choice, he thought he'd, quote, follow Charles Darwin. And the creation, so he writes to a generic Southern Baptist pastor, and he has a couple of key phrases in there, which I've quoted often since, especially some ideas I've said over the years. He said, let's put this generic again, pastor, representative pastor, let's meet on the near side of metaphysics. You have your heaven and I have mine. And he said, religion and science working together are the best hope that Earth has and that the living creatures on Earth have. And it's a kind of a change for Wilson in the past. He's, because of his background, the way some traditions treated science, he was kind of against Christianity and religion. And now he's recognizing that they can work together to bring about change. I should mention I wrote a blurb for that book, and Wilson actually wrote one for my previous book. It's called Sacramental Commons, Christian Ecological Ethics. So he's reaching out, and he told me that since the book came out, it's been invited that sometimes to congresses that have 1,000 or more evangelicals, and he said they're happy to see him there. He said they seem to be happy because the scientist is, quote, reaching out his hand to them. They've seen this antagonism in people anti-faith, anti-religion. So the fact that he recognizes that we don't all have to believe the same thing, we can, quote, meet on the other side of metaphysics on some important issues, such as ecological issues, we can work together to try to help to effect a better Earth and a change from the conduct that we've had to this point.
Absolutely. I noticed, you know, I mentioned earlier in the program, The Demon Haunted World, probably my favorite book by Sagan, although I've enjoyed a lot of his writing over the years. In that book, he's probably less critical of religions like Christianity than he is of belief in something like UFOs. But I always found, and this is the interesting thing about Carl Sagan to me, unlike the skeptic of today, he tended to be a lot more polite in his criticisms. He didn't tend to be the attack dog, and in fact, I even heard him refer to other skeptics as such. And I don't think that if we're going to have this debate, you know, that there's necessarily a need for anger, cynicism, you know, fighting, that sort of a thing. And unfortunately, skepticism today, I think it's often misunderstood for being skepticism when in fact it's more cynical. This is something that we tend to see. Sagan was something of an exception to that, and he certainly, I think, the humanitarian in him saw the good that religion can offer the world. It's so often touted by people of the atheist persuasion that, oh, religion does nothing good. Look back to the Crusades and look at, you know, circumcision and look at all these kinds of things. Name all the bad things, but there's also a tremendous amount of outreach and goodness that comes out of it, especially in the modern day.
Yeah, you can think of things like the Civil Rights Movement, which began in the black church in the South, and other movements of positive social change that have occurred. There are Crusades and Inquisition and other events like that, and religion very much involved in politics. It seems more for the, maybe for the ego of the religious leaders at times than because they really think it's there's a danger to their particular faith from science or politics or whatever. Yeah, Sagan himself had transitioned his life to where he gradually, I think, accepted finally the idea that there is other intelligent life in the universe. And I'm sure your listeners are aware that he wrote the novel Contact, which was made into a movie with Jodie Foster in a starring role that was based on his novel. So it's kind of, he became open to this possibility. And of course, and if you saw the film, the priest in there is a stereotypical kind of doesn't quite trust in science. So that there were some other characters that were somewhat stereotypical in the movie anyway. But at least that openness, he was willing to change from being adamant there was no such thing to thinking, considering the possibilities seriously. So I think that gets back to the notion of skeptic, that a real skeptic, in my opinion, it would be someone who's looking for some convincing sort of evidence, that they're open to the possibility of something other than what they think at the moment, and they're willing to change, but they just haven't found anything that is convincing to them or that enables them to be a bit more open. And, of course, you have the skeptics who are just maybe fearful in some ways or fearful of expressing interest, who self-censor because they're afraid of the reaction of others around them. And also it could have some deep religious meanings, depending on how strictly they hold conservative kinds of traditions in their religion and how much they might be open to other intelligent species in space who might look at divine being different than they do. You've probably heard about the evangelicals who want to baptize E.T. if they come here to save their souls. I mean, we're talking about people who have conceivably, if and of course we don't know this, if life follows a similar kind of pattern, I mean, they could be 8 billion years old if wherever they evolved went along the same lines, and by 4.5 billion years later, they became intelligent and got spaceships going, spacecraft going, and so forth. To think that every alien that was born before they met humans on Earth who were willing to baptize them went to hell because they didn't believe in Jesus as their savior. It's, of course, they say the same thing about people in the jungles and so forth who have the opportunity to become Christians. But anyway, this lack of openness, and the Bible focuses on the Christian scriptures, and it's also in the prophets, they focus on the God of love and mercy, and not this kind of vengeful God and God waiting to throw people into hellfires, as some of these churches are preaching about.
Yeah. I'm glad you point that out, in fact, because, you know, it is interesting. I think that there is a lot that can be brought to the argument of the potential for there being extraterrestrial intelligence somewhere out there, as many contend, perhaps, that has even visited Earth, but also that in relation to creation of the universe, whether there are forces that we would call God or something that is beyond, you know, what we would maybe consider otherwise to be our celestial peers, i.e. alien life. We're talking with Dr. John Hart, professor of Christian ethics at Boston University, and his book is Cosmic Commons, Spirit, Science, and Space. John, I want to ask you about what you refer to as discovery doctrine, and specifically how this could maybe occur in space, but also to the detriment of planets and intelligent life on them.
Discovery doctrine was developed significantly in the 15th century when the first European nations that have sailing ships that could travel at great distances were Portugal first, and then Spain played catch-up, and they became the two great European maritime powers. And they began deciding, since they met people who were less technologically advanced, they were claiming territory, and eventually started getting to battles with each other, and the Pope was then both a political leader as well as a religious leader, so they asked him to be a mediator, and he divided the earth along the meridian that went from the North Pole to the South Pole, and on the east, Portugal got all lands discovered, on the west, Spain did, but they agreed among themselves, they made a bend because the Portuguese had landed in Brazil, so they got Brazil, and that's why Brazil speaks Portuguese and the rest of Latin America Spanish. So it's like, okay, the two European countries have a right to all the territories on Earth, no matter who's there. And discovery doctrine had two basic tenets. First was, Europe is the world's superior civilization. By, of course, self-definition, they're projecting their civilization as the superior civilization of the world. Therefore, if they encountered other peoples, for, of course, the other people's benefit, that they would have a right to take their lands. They were supposed to do it, not take them outright, but make agreements with them, trade agreements, restrictive ones, and so forth. And eventually, as other countries came in, England and then other countries developed sailing ships, we had a lot more coming. So, but it went basically that when you, if you were the first one and you had to actually land, because some people from the sailing ship would look through a telescope and say they discovered something, but you had to land, put some kind of symbol of your presence, leave something behind, you know, to mark that as your particular monarch's land. And so if you think of probably the most famous paintings of Christopher Columbus, the longboat is on the shore, and he's planting the flag, the Spanish flag, and that's a symbol of discovery. So it had this political meaning. It didn't just mean seeing something new or finding something new. So you had the first criterion. Europe had the world's superior civilization, and therefore they had a right to take over and teach people, putting it nicely, about this superior culture, one of the marks of which was private property. So if a highly developed civilization elsewhere in the world didn't have private property, and of course most indigenous peoples were communal, and depending on how much they had developed, they might have a priesthood and royalty and so forth, but the land was owned in common or belonged to the monarchy as a whole. Without having individual property lines and so forth. But I would automatically make them an inferior civilization, even if they had astronomy, if they had fishing, they had agricultural fields, as was the case here, astronomy in Yucatan and southern Mexico. And so that was the first criterion. If by some miracle some culture were encountered that had all of these characteristics of the, quote, superior civilization, and the second criterion kicked in, which was Europe had the true religion, which was Christianity. Initially, it was Catholicism, but then other Protestant countries became involved, and they expanded that to Christianity. So you have a true religion, and it's not possible that people from distant places in the world would have even heard about, let alone become part of Christianity. So that gave them the right, and some interesting twists. If you discovered the headwaters of a river, and you had discovered all lands on both sides. So the French were the first to discover the mouth of the Mississippi. That's why the French had this whole vast swath of land right down through the center of the United States on both sides. They had all kinds of ways of, if a couple of nations are in an area, it's good for 150 miles or whatever it was outside of your initial place. And that's how they gradually settled and made treaties with native peoples, which soon became decimated by the diseases brought from Europe, so then they started taking their lands more forcibly. So So the idea is now, there's a whole history of the Americas, and it's carried over into slavery, into Africa, and so forth, the same line of discovery. So as we keep on going, this is still part of U.S. law, by the way, very key Supreme Court case in 1823 affirmed that. Maybe one more point on this. In Europe, if one country took over another, the person who, basically nobility or others who owned land, had property and land, they retained the property. They just owed their allegiance to their new ruler.
Right.
But in the United States, the Supreme Court decided in 1823 that it didn't apply here, that the discoverers, which had become the various states now of the United States, because the Indians were, quote, savages, didn't have the right to retain their lands the way that, quote, civilized nations in Europe did. And that is still being quoted. It's one of the things that exasperates me about some of the Supreme Court rulings. They quote a precedent without looking at the justice or injustice of the precedent and the fact that you had a racist statement unjustly taking native people's lands, their natural goods or resources, as they're also called. And it was all justified, and now it's all justified as recently as a court case in 2012 on the basis of this 1823 decision. So the problem is, as we start exploring space, well, the modern symbols of discovery, which people wouldn't have noticed, I'm guessing, unless you're familiar with the doctrine, when Neil Armstrong landed on the moon, before he landed, people were around the world were saying, put a United Nations flag, that this is really an accomplishment of humanity as a whole, and the United States as a country which has all these immigrants, as a nation of immigrants and so forth, would have been appropriate to put the UN flag if the U.S. insisted on putting the U.S. flag, which is actually a symbol of discovery. And then, as you might recall, a few years ago, the Russians went deep under the Arctic, and on the side of the North Pole, they planted a Russian flag. So these symbols are still there. They're using them to establish a claim to land. So once we start going into space, that's why the Outer Space Treaty was written and released by the UN, a fear of the U.S. and the USSR, which were then the only spacefaring nations or potentially spacefaring nations. They get into a war in the heavens, and of course would carry over back to Earth, so they tried to make agreements about it. Anything discovered in space, using the traditional meaning of the word discovered with a lowercase D and not a capital D, was both a common heritage of humankind. It wasn't supposed to belong to any nation. However, I was on a conference that included several NASA people, and one of the scientists said that someone he was familiar with was pressing that whatever is accomplished in space, that they make sure private property will obtain on whatever lands the U.S. might discover. And of course, that directly violates the Outer Space Treaty and other agreements. And you'd have to start having the thing that people feared of national competition and even warfare in space. So some people want to retain, even despite everything it has caused in this country, in terms of poverty and injustice and disparities and so forth, and the environmental destruction. They want private property in space so people can claim, well, it's my land, I can do with it as I will. So that's a danger, this idea of discovery. If you meet a civilization which is, again, not as technologically advanced, you know, maybe doesn't have the weapons or whatever else that humans might have as they go to space, that people would say we have a right to take these lands. And I think for your listeners who have seen the film Avatar, I already had published an article by the time that came out on this possibility, but it really illustrates in a fictional way what I've been writing in a nonfiction way, the danger of, and again, it repeats the what the Europeans did, is just carrying it over to space. If you run into an indigenous people and they have, in that case, the mineral unobtainium, that people can, despite the fact that it's in a sacred place and so forth, much has happened with the native peoples here. The European invaders acted the way that the invaders in Avatar do. And that's where I think is a real danger, that we have to change, as I talked about in the book, our consciousness and our conduct, because otherwise we'll replicate in space what we've been doing here. I mean, the environmental destruction. It's interesting, Hawking suggests we have to save some of us. That leaves, in other words, desert the planet and leave whoever's left here to deal with whatever's going to happen, instead saying, why don't we try to change things here? And then the other thing that struck me is people say, well, we've really been destructive to our environment on Earth, but we'll do differently in space. And my thought is, again, why wait? If you realize what you're doing wrong here, why wait until some nebulous future time to say, well, we're going to do better elsewhere. Why not do it here? So I hope this kind of dialogical thinking will take place. Well, if that's our vision of an ideal planet, why don't we try doing that here instead of waiting again until the future, try to put that into place?
Yeah, make it happen here and now and avoid. But then again, I think I've caught Mr. Hawking or Sir Hawking in a few of those kind of negativist outlooks from time to time. Maybe it's a product of one's upbringing. Who knows? But I mean, I've always been a firm believer. You know, we pick the path that we're on, and there's also time to change the path that you're on if necessary. Now, before we wrap things up, Dr. Hart, I wanted to ask you also a little bit about something that you proposed in one of our correspondences, which would be a shift from belief language to thought language. How can we apply that to UFOs, for instance?
Well, I think if people say, do you believe in UFOs? It's putting it on a metaphysical level. In my view, we are material and metaphysical beings. So we obviously have a body that we walk around in, and we have needs like food and so forth. But we can also be experience another dimension. And that's the spiritual dimension. And there might be dimensions. I'm not going to try to figure all that out. So belief is a matter of, often it's put in terms of religion. You know, do you believe in God, or do you believe in whatever particular religion might be advocating? Most people don't think that atheism is also a belief. It's a belief that there is no God. And theism is a belief that there is God. And either side can establish its position to the satisfaction of the other. So it's neither one is a fact, like in our material world, can be established. If you look on the other side of metaphysics, the reverse Wilson going on to speculative thought, that's one thing. So you can believe in God or under whatever name, Allah and so forth, or different doctrines about what you think this divine spirit is like and so forth. That's an entirely different level of saying, Linda, did you see those lights that went at right angles or zigzags in the sky, which people have seen? Then you know that it's a matter of thought. And for people who have seen them, it's not speculation, it's knowledge. Yes, I know that I have seen lights that act in ways that violate the known laws of physics, and meteors don't do those kinds of things. Don't tell me it's a meteor or whatever else. I've seen that, and those people saw them up close in the Hudson River, including about the nuclear power plant. They know what they've seen, and local newspapers reported on it. So it's a matter of knowledge. I think we have to progress from belief to thought language. And for example, you see a newspaper report, and instead of saying to a colleague or friend, do you believe in UFOs? You know, it could be along the lines of, what do you think about the possibility of extraterrestrial life and intelligently controlled crafts coming from space and so forth? So it's a matter of think, what do you think about this? It gives them room to ponder what this might mean and if they think it's a possibility and so forth. Whereas belief, it's so nebulous that, well, no, I don't believe in those, but I might think about it if I can find some credible evidence or credible witnesses that people say that they have experienced these things. And I think there are people who know that UFOs and extraterrestrial intelligent life exists because of the experiences they've had. So for them, it's not even a matter of thinking, as in the sense of pondering whether this is the case or not the case, because they've seen what they've seen. One of the people I interviewed for the book is Captain Robert Salas. This is one of the most unusual incidents that I heard about in Montana, where a UFO hovering above a missile control center, which controls 10 different nuclear missiles in silos. There are 150 altogether in Montana, and there are flights of 10 flights. When his missiles were shut down one by one, the lights went out, the alarms went off, after he saw an object directly overhead. And it's not a matter of, do you believe you saw the lights go out? Do you believe your missiles went offline? He tried three backup systems. He called Mounts from Air Force Base. They had three backups. I couldn't figure it out. And then finally, when they turned electric, and I forget who did it, was the contractor went out and they looked at it. It took them 3 days to repair it, and they said it took something that could generate an electromagnetic force 60 feet underground, which is where this control pod was located, to shut down the missiles. So they know, they've experienced it. They all have signed secrecy and non-disclosure statement. So they've had a direct experience with the impacts, in this case, on our nuclear defense system. And apparently the same thing happened in Russia in 1980. Oh, this was in 67 in the U.S. in 1980. And we don't know how many other incidents because the U.S. government is squelching and saying it doesn't really happen. So that's why I could just, for those people who actually have had some direct experience, they know that there are UFOs that, and they're intelligently controlled because of what they can do or what the beings in them can do. Others think there might be because they've heard stories and maybe a friend disclosed it to them that this is what I saw. And then they might start thinking about it. They don't have to believe in it because it's not a matter of belief. It's is there some material fact that somebody can present as showing that this has taken place or can take place and so forth. And I really like to shift away from the belief language because it puts it on that very nebulous. And a lot of people don't want to admit they believe in something, especially when it's been selectively put down in terms of government industry and so forth. But if you think it might be possible, and if we shift the language to thought, to consider the possibility, there's like a skeptic out there too, don't believe in UFOs or extraterrestrial intelligent life, but rather think, given the age of the universe, given how we've evolved on Earth, given now that NASA's projecting there, I think 10 billion to the B planets in the Milky Way galaxy alone that are Earth-like, then the likelihood, it would seem to me anyway, is that life didn't just evolve in one planet in the entire cosmos, you know, billions and billions of galaxies. So if you start adding that up, it can seem credible to you that if life evolved here, given the vast amount of time and so many kinds of planets, that perhaps, or in, according to Stephen Hawking's mathematical mind, it's highly probable that life has evolved elsewhere. So it becomes something to think about. But do you believe that there are planets out there that are Earth-like? Well, now we know there are, and that maybe they have evolved. And that can be a matter of speculation. I thought, well, there are other planets. I think they maybe could have evolved the way we have. If life progresses in similar ways. And again, that's life as we know it, though. It can be other kinds of life. So that's why I really, again, press that point. Don't say you believe in or I believe in, but rather I think there's a possibility. And if you're if you've actually seen something that you can trust the people you're saying, I know that it's a case. It actually happened, like this guy who spotted the aircraft coming in over the Atlantic when he was a spotter for the Air Force. So I encourage people to share. It might take a little courage on their part with very trusted friends, but asking to think, you see that story in the paper? What do you think about the possibility of life? And then depending on the other person's openness, and again, using the think language, maybe the person can disclose what they themselves have seen in their life.
Yeah, and open maybe new avenues, not just to thought and thought language, but also maybe avenues to communication that hadn't existed beforehand. Dr. Hart, if you would, please tell us where we can find your book online and how folks can reach you and find out more about you and what you do.
You can find, Amazon has both the hardcover and a Kindle version, and Barnes & Noble, I'm not sure if they would carry Amazon, so that's their brand, and Barnes & Noble has their own, but anyway, Barnes & Noble it might be up now. I haven't looked recently, but I know they will have it. And the publisher is Cascade Books. It's in Eugene, Oregon. It's a division of a larger publishing company called Wittgenstock. But anyway, if they Googled the title Cosmic Commons, it didn't come up on Barnes & Noble a week ago, but it might now, but it's been on Amazon since November. And then again, directly from the publisher, too, would be another possibility. And the Kindle is only $10. The paperback copy is $47, which is a lot. It's based on the number of pages. It's 430 pages, I think, is what it is. A lot of intricate information, a lot of research, endorsed by a National Medal of Science winner and molecular biologist who doesn't think there are UFOs, but he thought the book is something people should read, and he learned a lot from it. Nobel Peace Laureate, Elie Wiesel, professors from Oxford, from University of Padua in Italy, and other places who are saying it's a serious academic book. And that's what I want to do. I want to be something that's not just in the words of some, oh, it's just another UFO book, but to say this is, it's an academic subject that's worthy of studying and thinking about the possibilities if there is extraterrestrial intelligence. So Amazon is a quick response, the publisher, and I assume Barnes & Noble soon, if it's not there now. Oh, well, I'm at Boston University. I'm in the School of Theology, and my bio online is a little bit outdated. I don't update it as often as I should. It might be like 4 or 5 years old, but anyway, that's Amazon, I should mention, I have this author's profile, and I've got an updated version of kind of what I call my one-page life story on Amazon under the author's profile section. And links to my other books are on there, too.
Excellent. Well, Dr. John Hart, it has been my pleasure to have you here on the program. You know, I hope maybe you'll come back sometime, and much continued success with Cosmic Commons, Spirit Science, and Space. You have a wonderful time up there in Boston. Do stay warm, though, okay?
Okay. Thanks a lot, and thanks for the invitation. It's been good talking with you.
Well, I hope we can do it again sometime. And again, yeah, take care. We will be in touch again in the future. And thank you again for being my guest tonight on the Grailian Report. That is Dr. John Hart, professor of Christian ethics at Boston University, and very, very fascinating individual. I have to say, it's so important in my way of thinking, it really is, that we are able to bring academic perspectives and true academic discussion to this debate, because nobody, some would tell you, want to take UFOs seriously. Clearly there are people of sound mind and also of a learned disposition who want to. So bless you, Dr. Hart, for taking up the calls. We'll wrap things up for this week's edition of the program. When we come back, it is the Grailian Report. Don't go anywhere. For most of us, chocolate is a guilty pleasure. Come on, admit it. You've got a sweet tooth just like the rest of us. But if I told you that eating chocolate was actually really good for your health and happiness, you'd probably say I was in La La Land. Hey, I wouldn't argue. Here's why. Every batch of the fine handcrafted chocolates at La La Land Organics Raw Chocolate is made from scratch, using organic, fair trade, and 100% natural ingredients. From the first bite, you'll know you're enjoying true quality, and the heart shape isn't the only way you'll feel the love. In fact, every chocolate from La La Land Organics is made by Melody Dawn Germain herself, and according to her own special recipe. You'll be enjoying Ecuadorian heirloom cacao in every bite, along with a selection of wholesome herbs and superfood supplements that not only make La La Land Organics delicious, but really good for your health and happiness. They're all natural, gluten-free, and no dairy, soy, or refined sugars are included, which help them boost your energy, reduce stress, and promote longevity. And as if healthy organic chocolates didn't remove the guilt factor enough, Melody ships all her orders in reusable, food-grade, non-BPA containers designed to eliminate toxic residue and cut down on environmental waste. Be sure and visit Melody's website at www.mdgnewmedia.com. That website again is mdgnewmedia.com. Just click chocolate in the toolbar at the top of the page. You can't miss it. And while you're there, you can see a full list of the ingredients that will be sure to put a smile on your face. And I promise, it's guilt-free. La La Land Organics Raw Chocolate. Why wait? That website again is mdgnewmedia.com. Inspiration from across the fabric of space-time. It is the Grailian Report. I'm your host, Micah Hanks. Always be glad to be piloting this intergalactic model, whatever we call it. You know, it's been known by many names over the years, and I'll tell you this, on the interior, there's a lot more space than one would perceive from the outside. Take it for what it is. As we marvel over science, and of course we thank our guest, Dr. John Hart, for joining us tonight discussing his book, which we'll have more information about linked up there in the show notes at graylingreport.com. I look at some of the innovations that exist on yonder horizon. For instance, there's one woman right now who may be, in the coming weeks, the first in the world to give birth from a transplanted womb after doctors successfully introduced an embryo into her body. And this embryo was transferred last week. This was months after the unidentified woman who has a genetic condition. That means she was born without a womb. She became one of nine to receive pioneering transplants last year. You've heard of heart transplants, kidney transplants. What about transplanted wombs? Now, this was donated by the woman's mother so that a baby could also be the firstborn to a woman using the same womb from which she herself had emerged. How fascinating is that? Some might consider it just a little freakish, but in truth, I think that if it allows the woman to pursue her dream of course, parenting and, of course, having a family of her own, I think that's beautiful. And this is something that science affords us. And it's so important, as I think we've seen tonight, to always be mindful of trying to bridge that gap between science, skepticism, belief, open-mindedness, all of this, religion, and find that common ground, that important common ground where we can share in insight and knowledge with one another and hopefully make the world a better place. That, personally, is what motivates me, and that's why we like to bring you news, knowledge, insight, and innovation from beyond the fringe here every week on the Graylian Report. Hey, if you'd like to share something with me for inclusion on the program, email me info@graylianreport.com. You can also find me info@micahhanks.com, and that's my website, micahhanks.com, in addition to this one that you know and love. We'll talk to you again next week, and on behalf of Matthew Oakley, Tyler Pittman, Caleb Hanks, John Anderson, Dick Oakley, and yours truly, the mouth of the South, Micah Hanks, I bid you adieu, my friends. As always, stay strange and take care of one another out there.
You've been listening to The Graylian Report with Micah Hanks. Any rebroadcast or duplication of this program or program content without express written permission is strictly prohibited. The Graylian Report, in direct cooperation with the internet website, graylianreport.com.